The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, now we both look like video gamers. We should be playing Minecraft or something. I'm going to try one more time with your bio, and we'll start this time. I think it's going to work. You sound a lot better. Christine Louis-DeSully is a freelance writer, and she is currently researching for a second PhD. Her research is focused on the issues of race, identity, social justice, and the demand for safe spaces in the United States and in UK universities. Her book from Zero Books is entitled Transcending Racial Divisions, Will You Stand By Me? And in it, she examines the origins of racial thinking and the relationship between race and culture. Christine, welcome to the Zero Books channel. We've finally gotten everything set up properly. We both look like we're gaming nerds, you even more than I do with the headset.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm glad to have you on. You know, before we started this time, you were talking a little bit about, you were talking about how identity politics is thought of as a left-wing phenomenon and as maybe even exclusive to the left, and that you disagreed with that. And I thought maybe I'd give you a chance to start with that observation, that identity politics is not really a left-wing project.
It's not a left-wing. I mean, it's a left-wing. The left has taken up identity politics, but I see the identity politics has started from the 18th, 19th century with the issue of race, for example, or nations and culture. So the identity politics for me started from the right side. And unfortunately, the left has taken up identity politics as their main politics. That's my problem. And the way I understand identity politics is basically the taking up social identities and using social identities into politics. So you use social identities into politics, and this is why race was one of the first social identities being used in politics, i.e. identity politics. The problems with the left today is that they only use social identity in politics, and they have given up on universalist politics, which I see is as proper politics. So for me, identity politics and politics is two different things. And in the book and later on in my research, I tried to show how politics has basically been damaged by this use of social identity for different groups of people, basically use the identity to fight for their own identity group's interest. I'm old enough to be to have lived in a time where if you were black, people would expect you to be only discussing race. And if you were discussing race, you also have problems with jobs. And for me, I was more interested anyway in science. But I have a left-wing, radical left politics. And the reason why I wrote the book, actually, is because I started to... I started with the PhD on safe space at UK and US universities. And I wonder, why is it that black students felt the need to ask for safe space at university? What's beyond that? So because black safe space, there is black safe space, but also a woman asking for safe space, and gay, lesbian, so different groups of identity are asking for safe space. But I decided to target the black to focus on the black, not to target them.
Yeah, right.
So focus on the black, because for me, I wanted to understand why is it that students at university are asking for political have a political aim of demanding safe space, and this is how discussing the social identity. So they see themselves as black, and then as black people, they're asking for a space for themselves at university. So a social identity into political demands, and this is how I try to understand the issue of social identity, identity politics, and race, basically.
Where did the idea of safe space come from? I have this impression that it came out of the 70s and consciousness raising feminist organizations, and that it came out of the idea that women were especially oppressed and victims of violence, and that they needed to create areas where they could encounter each other in a safe environment to help each other heal from the ravages of being in a patriarchal society. And that maybe came up in the 70s as part of a militant feminist movement. Would that be correct? Or what was the origin of that idea?
The origins, it's feminist and also gay and lesbian rights. So basically, and then they end up also with the civil rights and black groups. So it's a space for groups of people who were marginalized or oppressed, and they needed a space to be able to develop political ideas or to protect themselves against violence, also domestic violence or racist violence or gay and lesbian violence. So this is how the safe space basically kind of started in a way. This is how I understand it. I didn't go too far on the understanding of safe space, I have to say, except the fact that today the safe space is more of a psychological it's based on a psychological understanding that individuals need a space to be able to feel better. So it's a mix of politics and not politics at all. It's a mix of politics and psychology that you need as an individual or as a group, a space where you can express some ideas that you cannot do in normal society. But yes, feminism, gay, lesbian, black groups were the ones who were asking for safe space in the past, in the 60s, 70s. It's when identity politics, in a sense, started. In the left, I mean.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think this question of the safe space informs anti-racist politics in general? Now, what are the characteristics of anti-racist politics today? Are they different from this sort of therapeutic approach to politics that we've been talking about?
Well, the therapeutic approach to politics is part of the anti-racist, mainstream anti-racism today. So the way that anti-racism is being understood today is based on the way that racism is understood also from the mid-20th century. So racism has been turned into a problems of individual behavior and a problems of individual attitudes. And after the Second World War. So even though the racial thinking and race problems was introduced by the elite or the ruling class or the intellectuals, racism and with policies introduced by the governments, racism after the Second World War was turned into an issue of individual behavior and individual attitudes. And anti-racism has been turned into challenging individual behavior and individual attitudes. So when you talk to people who are discussing anti-racism, most of them seeing as a problem of individuals. Unfortunately, they usually see as a problem of the uneducated working class individual who cannot understand what it is to be human, or you can understand this idea of common humanity. So it's always an individual problems, and that somehow you have the enlightenment people who can teach the knowledge of humanities to the So the groups or people are not enlightened. I don't know if it's unenlightened. My English is lost sometimes. The anti-racism is based on psychology today. It's based on therapeutic behavior in the sense of victimhood. So blacks are seen as victims, and you need to be able to kind of protect them from different from words, from actions. It's based on asserting the idea of cultural identity. So we have a black identity, and we want to assert this identity to be able to feel better. So the turn to our psychology has been quite important on the level of anti-racism, and that is what is one of the main problems of anti-racism today. So racism is not seen as a social problem, it's introduced as an individual problem.
No, most everyone I know who talks about racism in the United States will talk about it as systemic racism. Right. And that's the language that's the term that's used. We have to fight systemic racism. But what you're describing doesn't sound systemic at all. It sounds possibly these racist attitudes are culturally determined or biologically determined. In other words, maybe people have evolved to favor their own tribe, you know, that favor people who look like themselves as a marker of a group identity. You might hear about that. But if you think about systemic racism, you would seem to me to point towards institutions and productive systems. You know, as a Marxist, I think of the economic systems that we live under or through. But what do you think people are talking about when they talk about systemic racism today? And is that a path away from the kind of anti-racism that individualizes everything that you're talking about?
My understanding of when some people discussing, because it seems that when you listen to what people say about systemic racism, systemic racism, there is different understanding. But my understanding of how they see it is, it's a bit like it's related to a lot of the way that people see racism as this perverted, you know, this things that you have in society it's invading the whole our whole life. So it has this kind of mystical connotations of racism that it goes through all institutions and through all our behavior and through all our mental and morality. So it's basically looking at racism as if it was a mystical and things happening in society that we cannot do anything about it because it's invading all our life at different level.
It's a specter that's haunting the society, maybe. You know, racism is like a spirit that has a system of its own that we can't quite comprehend. But this is impacting us. Yeah.
So you could say that, you know, the racial relationship is related to the way society is organized. So if we're talking about Marxist social relational productions and how some people have been used in one way or the other to organize society. But the systemic racism, the way I see it, is always as a way of, a spectrum, something that we cannot, we cannot deal with it because it's just so big. It's everywhere. And if you look at some of the books, this is how they express their systemic. They don't define what is systemic. They don't say it's only institution. It's like it's everywhere. And then if it's everywhere, then human beings will have problems dealing with racism. So it's no more a social problem where we can understand how society is organized and what makes some groups seen as inferior compared to other. It becomes part of our life, of part of a human society, part of the natural. It makes it more of a natural things than social, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So I don't like this systemic racism. I agree that there is a racism part of the institutions, and there's policies and laws that creating different sections of society to be oppressed or exploited. But the systemic racism, that the way it's been talked about, is too much of a out of control things that human has to deal with. And I think it's also, in one way, an anti-human way of understanding the problem, the social problem.
You know, I want to get to something in your book that may not seem directly related to what we've been talking about so far, but which I think is related. And it's this idea of the inner voice. I've written the question down. In your book, you describe Kenan Malik's description of the history of the inner life or the inner voice. Mm-hmm. The significance of the inner voice as a way to understand the world, or and to get, I guess, and you listen to your inner voice and you know who you really are. And how did this idea of the inner voice get, which I think at first was the inner voice of reason, get transformed into an inner essence? And do you think that's connected to the way in which we think about a mystical concept like systemic racism?
Before I answer the inner voice things, there's one thing that I wanted to say, because this is one of the, for me, irritating arguments, and I have to say I'm going to be kind of blunt. I think it's one of the stupid arguments that you could hear all the time around race. It's the idea that somehow we have this natural evolution where we are going to be into tribes and community. When you think about what does it mean, tribe and community, you can be tribe and community divided by race, by politics, by height, by family. It's something that people use. They say, "Oh, it's us and them, or tribe and community," and it doesn't explain anything, because it explains everything. You know, do people define a community with a family, or do they define it by race, or do they define it by culture, or do they define it by geographical space? And you can explain everything by just saying it's us and them.
I think most of the time it's defined by what television shows you like and what music
for example,
you listen to.
Or education. I mean, should I be, like, my tribe is the education people with a doctor, you know, a PhD, and my, should I be this tribe or the tribe where I'm black or the tribe when I'm a woman? And then every time that there is a conflict between me and somebody else, people will say, it's my tribe. Which tribe are you talking about? And that's why I think it's just irritating to hear these things all the time, because it really doesn't explain everything. And in fact, it's a way of dismissing the problems. You know, you can think about, I was discussing with somebody with Israel and Palestine, and we said, well, it's a tribe and community issue. I mean, in that case, the World War II was a tribe and community issue.
Right.
And, you know, slavery is a tribe and community issue. Anyway, so on the inner voice, it's, I think this is, when I look at the research, the understanding of the inner voice started with the Enlightenment intellectuals, for example, Kant. And his argument was that you have to understand the world, it's through your own mind. You can do it through your mind. So you have an inner voice to be able to help you understanding the world. So Kant's, I'm not sure if I explained it, but Kant's aim was to be able to found a space for human freedom. And so it wasn't just about nature, it was about humans and the ability to reason, to give them understanding of the world. And so you have the inner voice that gives us something about the world, understanding about the world. But that was taken up by the Romantic school. And the Romantic school is a counter-enlightenment school, where instead of pushing the idea of reason, they're pushing the idea of creativity, emotions, and personal sentiment that is not related to reason. So you go from the inner voice of understanding the world away from nature to the inner essence where it's us inside that we have a certain essential part of ourselves that give us give us understanding. So basically, it becomes an inner essence, becomes a natural essence, something that is given to us. So it goes from reason to emotions and essentialism. Basically, this is how. So from Kant looking for human freedom to Romanticism having essentialism, an essential part of a human that cannot be controlled. So
what motivated the Romantics politically? What were they rebelling against in terms of political power? Was this an attempt to return to some sort of religious tradition, or was it? I should know this, I think, but what were the political motivations behind this turn towards the emotions?
I think that was Romanticism is quite wide, and the Romantic. I'm not an expert on that. I would like to that yet, but I would like to read about it. So all my reading is new, but my understanding of the Romantic movements is that there is different movements, and each of the movements are different in different countries. So you have the German Romanticism, the French Romanticism, and British Romanticism, and they didn't have the same ideas or the same reaction to ideas. But one of the reaction to one of the ideas of the Romantic school was to challenge this idea of reason. So you had part of the people, part of the Enlightenment, or part of the rationalist school, who argued that only reason can make us understand the world, and so the Romantic had decided that somehow you have to have human subjectivity and experience. So in one way, Kant is using both reason and human experience to be able to understand the world. So there was a reaction to this idea that somehow it's only human reason that can make us understand the world. And some of the Romantic argue for emotions and human experience and subjectivity. And this is how I understand it, how it started, basically. I'm not an expert on all this.
I'm vaguely familiar with some of this as well. I mean, when it comes to the philosophers like Kant and others, I have an inkling, but I'm curious to know, and maybe I'll cut that all out, but I'm curious to know how the turn towards Romanticism might have been politically motivated. But to go back to the question of emotions versus reason, or the role that an inner essence might have played, it seems, in determining who you are, in determining what is right, this emotion that comes from a kind of undefined or inscrutable essence within, it seems to me that I understand sort of intuitively maybe why that would be appealing to people, because when everything comes down to reason, it seems rather cold. And also people need concepts and even relationships that they can take for granted and rely upon and not examine critically or, you know, with reason, in order to have a sense of a meaningful experience, I think. So I think that, like, the Romantics were turning against reason because they thought it stripped the world of poetry and meaning, right? This also might inform the need for grasping after an identity, whether it's, you know, a racial identity or even an identity based on your love of a television show, you know, this need to feel like you have a strong inner essence. Do you think that the kind of humanism that focuses on reason might be able to compete in terms of providing people with the kinds of experiences they need, the grounding that they need. Can we compete with the Romantics?
I think there is a certain misunderstanding, because I think when I push the human reason, it's not as if I say that it is only what we have to understand the world. It's more like, for me, and also because a lot of people, I think, has a tendency of misunderstanding what reason means. And they very often looking at reason as if it was logic. So this is why this idea of human reason is called. And for me, human reason is not called, because human reason is this, express the ability for human beings to understand the world. This is an important, this is the most, for me, the most important part of humanity, in a way, that we have an ability to observe the world, to analyze it, to understand it, and then from our understanding to act on it. This is what I'm talking about human reason. And if we only looking at human reason as if it was logical, then like mathematics, then yes, it becomes cold. But even when it comes to a human emotion, there is, you can use human reason. So I don't like this this contradiction that people put between a human emotion and human and reason. It has to be working together. We are not, when we use our understanding of the world, we also use part of our emotions and our human experiences. So I don't want to be honest, to have a humanism where we're forgetting that we are, we look at the world through our own senses. I mean, I found it weird that people kind of forget that everything that when we understand it, we also understand it as individuals through our senses. So we have, as a society, we're trying to understand the world, but as individual, we also look through our senses. It's never possible to have the world objectively and us, and then we have the world without going through ourselves. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, is absolutely.
This is the problem with the rationalists, is that they seem to think that we can have a world out there and then we can understand it without human experiences. And it's not possible. You have an objective world, but it is through ourselves that we can understand it. We can interpret it.
Yeah. The other day I was working on editing a video. And when I do that, I go through our archival footage from old public domain films. And one of them was about perception. And I found this old black and white film about perception. And it was in the clip I saw of it, it was pointed out that when you see something, you're not just seeing with your eyes, you're seeing with your whole body. Because if you see something that's, and you say, okay, it's right in front of me, that's your brain's processing that based on not just your sight, but the position of your body, the position of your head. So if you turn your head, now you know that you're looking to your right, and you know that this is to your right, not because of what you see, but because of also how you feel. And I think that's maybe relates to what you're saying about reason, that reason is coming out of the whole of experience.
But it's not only how you feel. I have this thing since I was a kid. You try to understand the word infinity. And as a human beings in 21st century, we cannot understand the real concepts of infinity, in the sense of we cannot understand what infinity really means. I've always been fascinated by that, because when you really try to apply what it means, infinity, because we are human beings, we don't have at the moment the concepts to understand it, it just basically become completely, I'm going to look like I'm a mad woman, but you know, it's just like, it's like you're going away from what you can. So it's, when to understand the world, we understand it through concepts. It's not only our feelings, but we understand it through our concepts, and the concepts can be changed. So if you take an understanding today and you go back 2,000 years and you discuss, for example, race 2,000 years, they would not understand what you're talking about because they didn't have the concept. So it's not only that. It's not only the feeling. It's we interpret the world through something that was given to us when we are a baby. So we are being socialized with different concepts and with this understanding. And then we carry on interpreting with those concepts and we develop new concepts. So it's not only about feelings. Well,
no, that's absolutely right. And to make it really concrete, like just right now, if I were a person of the, let's say, 17th century, and I was having this experience that I'm having right now, talking to you this way, mm-hmm. I would be utterly confused. Like what, you know, like what, where the voice is coming from? What is this? I mean, and what is the relationship? I might eventually be able to work it out. Right. But it would take some effort. Whereas now it's very natural for me to think, oh yeah, I'm talking to Christine on my computer and that's her voice I'm hearing. And it's all matching up. So yeah, the kinds of experiences, even that we can easily interpret in a seemingly natural way without a lot of critical engagement, those are clearly like developed historically through our experience and through the changes that we've made in the world. So, and it doesn't seem that much more difficult to understand that, or very different than understanding when I think something's in front of me, it's not just because of what I see. It's not just the data that I receive from my eyes, but it's also my whole experience in the moment. So let's see if we can get back to talking about race. I'm fascinated by this question of identity and essence and how reason relates to history and all of that. But
I'm still doing my ideas have changed. So the book in one way is like I keep saying to my friends, it's a beginning of a journey because I started to, I mean, I had a political position on race for a long time. And when I decided to really look at the issue myself, you know, you realize that sometimes people interpret things in a way that you wouldn't interpret the same way. And also a lot of ideas are being digested by other people and they're not necessarily the right ideas. And when I started to do the research, this idea of identity and the self and social identity is very important for us to understand because I think race is related to that. But this idea, what it means to be an individual, how we see us, the self, and how do we define identity? Because people always say, well, we always have an identity, but it's not true. How we saw ourselves as human beings is not something that is fixed. How we see the self, as the self has been a discussion, philosophical discussions for human history, but it has changed. A Greek would not see the self the same way that we see the self today. You know what I mean? It's a fascinating mm-hmm. discussion because the way we see, for me, the reason why I'm against identity politics is also because the way we, for me, we understand identity and the self, I think, is going in the wrong direction. It becomes a psychological way of understanding our human, and instead of a more of a social. So the way we see ourselves is very important to understand, so we can understand why politics has changed on that level. I'm excited. So
yeah. You know, I mentioned at the outset that I was in therapy, which is rather new for me, but one of the difficulties I'm running up against as I go through therapy, I'm talking to a Lacanian, which is good. You know, I like Slavoj Žižek, so I picked someone who knew something about Lacan to talk to. But it is realizing that all of the emotional and relational issues that I'm having and I'm talking about are not natural. They're not fixed. Even my neurosis and my emotional problems could be seen as a product of the kinds of freedom that's being developed and a challenge to work on it more and to change.
I think the conception of freedom is a very wrong conception of freedom that we have today. And there is quite a few, author who looked at the different concepts. That's also another thing that also fascinates the discussions about freedom and the discussions about citizenship is also something that I I'm looking at. Freedom for the Greek, for example, is not the same as freedom it is today. The way we understand freedom most of the time today is what is called the liberal freedom. So the freedom away from the state's interventions in our personal life. When people used to have a concept of freedom, which is more what some people call republican freedom, where it's basically the freedom to control your life, but also to govern as yourself. So it's freedom from dominations and freedoms from interventions. It's two different type of freedoms. And I personally think that the way we understand freedom today is a restriction to people who want to change society for the better. Because basically, the way that it's been developed, when you think about, I was reading about Benton, is that somehow, instead of saying, we do not have freedom because we are dominated and exploited, you end up having a liberal freedom saying, you know, you can go to work and you can choose your work, your employer. So now you must be free. So so you're still dominated, but you can still choose your employer. You can choose to work. So it's no more freedom for domination. It's freedom to choose or freedom away from the state's intervention to decide which employer you should be working for. So it's not freedom. It's freedom in a limited way. But racial thinking was developed in this time when the idea of freedom, but also the idea of equality. I think one of the important ideas that was developed was the idea of equality. So you could not, for example, slavery and racial thinking would not have any sense unless you have already the notions of equality. And the racial thinking was developed in a way of explaining why, if we want, why the Enlightenment philosopher wanted to have a society where people were feeling better, were working better, or living in a better life and being equal. And then you still a reality, social reality of society where actually there is different groups of people, and some of them, the working class, for example, were at the bottom of society. So they have to explain, why is it that we have a notion of equality in a world where there is no equality? And racial thinking actually was developed to explain the difference between the aristocrats and the lower classes, so the working class. Before it was used to separate the black and the white, or black and people use all kind of name, brown or yellow, whatever. But between the upper and the lower, amongst the Europeans and the other races, before that they use it with the aristocrats and the working class. Why is it that the working class are degenerate or poor? It's because they are from a different races from the aristocrats, and that was later used with the why is it that Europeans are better than the blacks and better than the Indians and whatever. So you had different concepts that been used. Had to be developed to be able to have the development of racial thinking. Another thing that one of the very interesting writer is even Anna Ford, who basically showed that the concept of race could not have developed unless some ideas had to be given up. And so the idea of citizenship of the Greek had to be given up through the ages to be able to have the concepts of race. So an it showed that this is an anti-political development to have the issue of race compared to the politics of the Greek and later on for the Romans. So you have the racial thinking was developed with different ideas and counter ideas. And for me, I see racial thinking is developed as a counter enlightenment more than a part of the enlightenment. But the concept of citizen change throughout humanity. So you have the citizenship and politics was developed by the Greek. But even within the antiquity, within the Greek society, you had different concepts of citizenship, which was also, again, changed with the Roman. And then a change with, you know, when you had the kings and the monarchy, so they would be the subject.
You were no longer a citizen, you were a subject of the king.
Yes,
right.
The citizenship, the Greek, was a citizenship where you participate. Of course, the citizens of the Greek world was very restricted to only a few, a minority of people. If you were not a citizen, you were part of the house world. You were part of the private. You were part of the nature world. And the citizens were a select groups of people. But the citizenship was part of you of deciding how you organize society. That was kind of a participatory, you know, aspect of citizenship where you are governing yourself. This is not today. Citizenship is not understood basically that way. It's more of a, we are all equal in front of the law. But the idea that somehow we, all of us, control how we are governed is just gone. That's the reason why when people are talking about democracy, rule of the people, most people just kind of ignore what it really means in the first place. So the citizenship has a long history, has changed. But for me, the way I look at it at the moment is in the 18th, 19th century, especially the 19th century, some of the concepts of, like freedom were changed away from the you know, the idea of emancipation. So freedom, equality, citizenship were changed, and it's the counter-enlightenment who won the arguments. Reactionary anti-left arguments is won by the during the 19th century. This is how I see it. So freedom as liberal freedom,
like with in 1848, the fact that revolution failed, that was a victory for the counter enlightenment and the counter revolution. You think, or in the early 20th century. The failure of the German Revolution in 1919, that would have been also a part of the counter enlightenment, possibly. Is that would you say that's true?
Yes, but yes, I mean you're talking about the working class losing the conflict, but I'm talking about counter enlightenment. It's not only the working class losing the conflict, but also ideology. So when you develop ideas that goes against, so for example, the concept of freedom, when you develop the idea of freedom that is just away from intervention, so you have the freedom, basically it's a capitalist notion of freedom. The capitalists can do what they want without the state intervening in what they're doing. So they can do what they want with workers without the state intervening. So the concept themselves were won by the counter-enlightenment. And these concepts, when they change, they go against the interest of particular groups of people, i.e. the working class. So it's not only the 1848 or 1970s revolution. I mean, that has a big, it's important, but it's also ideologically, the ideas of being, ideological conflict that is also important as well. I think if you change the concepts in a way that is useful for the status quo, like for example anti-racism, for me anti-racism today, the mainstream is a concept that is keep the status quo. It's a conservative anti-racist movement. It's nothing to do with social transformation. So basically the anti-racist and the left has given up or has abandoned these old ideas that will allow us to be able to transform society for the better. So this is how we lost.
You earlier described your book as the beginning of a journey and mentioned the fact that some of your ideas have changed or developed since you've wrote the book that's out now. Where do you think you're going next on the journey of discovering this return to humanism, I think is how I describe it. But also what what did you encounter that kind of moved you to alter course a little bit?
You mean, why did I move a little bit my political positions?
Yeah. And actually, what political positions did you move? Like, what, where were you and where are you now? How about that?
I mean, some of my positions have changed. Some of my
I'm only interested in the ones that have changed.
Let's put it this way. In the course of my research, I realized that this idea that somehow reviving this supposedly liberal value is a way forward. First of all, because I the more I do reading about liberalism, and the more I realize that a lot of the problems that we have, especially in the left, it's based on the liberal ideas being introduced into radical left ideas. So, and I see liberalism as a way of keeping the status quo more than changing. So it may have been a positive in the beginning compared to, I mean, the early liberal may have been a little bit more positive groups of people in the beginning of liberalism. But at the moment, I see liberalism as conservative way of keeping the way things are. And so I am much more anti-liberalism than I used to be.
Do you mean the emphasis on market relations and property and the idea that what is most important is getting the state out of the way so that entrepreneurship and creativity can take place to direct society through the market? Or do you mean liberalism as in the idea that all men are created, all men and women, I should not, yeah, are created equal, and that protecting speech, the speech rights of the individual, the privacy rights of the individual, and the freedom of the individual is a key to having a not only a good society, but a society that can change and progress? Which part of liberalism are you rejecting, or do you think they're intertwined?
You know, when I was thinking before, I was like, what is liberalism? And then you look at the people discussing liberalism, and there is no definition of liberalism. So when I said I'm anti-liberalism more than I used to be, it's more like the idea, for example, that individual freedom is the most is the only thing that we basically, this is how they're looking at the individual freedom is the only thing that we are looking at. So the liberalism is based on the idea that somehow we are individuals in society. So we are, they don't see society as such anymore. They see individuals basically as an aggregate of individuals. And that somehow we have to fight for individual freedom, so then we will be free. And individual freedoms in an aggregate society, maybe, but this is not what we are living today. So I will support some of the liberal values, like, for example, I believe in free speech, and I will say nearly, I will say absolute free speech, some people will argue. So I really believe in free speech. But at the same time, I do not think that free speech is freedom. Because for me, freedom is to be able to have freedom for domination, to be able to have ordinary people to govern themselves. And this is not going to happen in a society where we, the current society that we have in the capitalist society. So for me, the liberalism is kind of a way of keeping, or let's put it this way, it's been used as a way of putting capitalism as if it was a natural system.
Mm-hmm.
As if it was the way that we're living today is something that is permanent, natural, that is just given, that you know, this is the way human lives, and that somehow we need to be able to live within this way of organizing, and we have to improve ourselves with civil liberties and liberal values. And that's why I think it's a problem for the left to only use liberal values as a way of fighting for human freedom, because human freedom is basically not in on the card by liberalism. I don't know if I explain it. I see the way for me I see it is that if you are a left wing and you want to, if you understand human developments as individual to be able to control their, not only their private life, because that's what liberalism is asking you, away from the state, it means you're free in your private life. But what about governing our society? Where is our freedom? Where is our freedom to away from giving us our labor? If you don't want to work, you're in trouble. So this freedom is completely out of the cards. So they are telling us that we need to have freedom within our life. Like I can decide if I want to smoke or not to smoke. But this is not freedom. This is just freedom within my private life. But what about...
Do you ever hear the old Devo song called Freedom of Choice? The point of the song is that if all you have is the choice between smoking and not smoking, or the choice between this or that product, or the choice between trying to swim away from a sinking ship or going down with it, that's not real freedom, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, I agree with you. And I would go further and say, not only do we have to struggle for freedom from domination, but we have to struggle for the right to reimagine and create something new in terms of how we organize our productive life, so we can be more materially free, not just free from domination, but free to reach beyond where we're at now, both as individuals and in society. You know, like for me, I guess, as a science fiction writer, you know, the idea of space exploration is the way I mythically imagine freedom, right? You know, we're going to develop a way to get out off the planet and into a whole new realms. And we'll do that through our reason and by coming together more effectively.
This is the beauty of, I'm anti-capitalist today, but there is some positive things about it. I mean, capitalism is the first society where basically we are all together. We are dependent on each other. It's a cooperative society. So in what I eat or what I mean, my computer hasn't been developed or produced by me. It is being produced by other people. So it's a cooperative a world, but at the same time, it's also a competitive world. It puts us in competition against each other. And so there is always this tension between the corporations creating the world that all humanity can do, you know, improve and develop. So material conditions and technology and science and morality. At the same time, there is this individual competition that we have to do to be able to live. So this is the problems for me, is that we can go further than that. And yeah. Human development is not, but not only technology. Human development is also the idea of we can create, like you said, reason, but also creativity. As human, we could have a world where what we are producing is about us, not about the employers. It's not about nature. It's about us. It's about human. It's about humanity. It's about being mm-hmm. human. Being further than what we have today,
and not being trapped in one definition of what a human being is, but understanding the human power to change.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.